I was given orders to start and I obey. Just a word, I've in different, over the years, I've given many introductions to this subject, starting from many directions. And when I was preparing, when I was thinking about this series, I was debating which introduction to use, what should be my starting point. And then I decided that it should be all of them. So, I mean, the plan is to give several introductions. I may have given one already on the first day, and here is another. And I think it should be good for all of us, because it means less preparation for me, because I can repeat things that I've said before. But it also means for you a sort of renewed motivation on different days, okay? So this is the algebraic knot theory introduction. You may find it a little bit unrelated to things I previously said, but somehow that's the point. And you may also find that it does relate at the end. So wait for that, it will relate, okay? So maybe I'll start with three basic problems in knot theory. Sort of the first problem we always introduce is separate knots. Okay? But at some point you get bored of that and you want to ask other questions. By the way, if you want an analogy, I like to think of knot theory as number theory and as knots as numbers. Of knots as numbers, in the sense that number theorists don't really care about numbers. Okay? It's not that number theorists really, really care about 233,212. Okay? What they care is about somehow the math, the interesting math that number theory, that questions about numbers leads them to study. And in the same way, I can't really care about knots. I mean, after all, there is only one knot that I know how to draw. So my real motivation, so for me, knot theory is really an excuse to get into all sorts of other lovely topics. And then, you know, if you continue the analogy, separating knots is like the extremely difficult problem in number theory of deciding whether two integers are equal or not, okay? It's not really what's interesting, okay? Sorry, I'm kidding. It's not the interesting problem. And then, but finding properties of knots is more like finding properties of integers, and that's the more interesting thing. Anyway, sorry, this is just an aside. So back to knot theory, there are several properties that knots may or may not have, and I want to study those. And I'll mention only three of them, even though there are more. Okay? So the first one is to determine the genus of a knot. So you may know that every knot can be presented as a boundary of an oriented surface. Here is an example. The knot here is, I think it's the figure eight knot. And, if you stare at it for a little while, you'll see that it's the boundary of a certain oriented surface. And again, a standard theorem says that every knot is the boundary of a surface. And then the question is, what's the minimal genus of such a surface? Okay? So, arguably the question has been solved, because I think you can read off the genus, the minimal genus of a knot, from Higgard floor homology. Okay? But there is also always room for another solution, because you can't always compute Higgard floor homology. It might be difficult to compute. If you're given a complicated knot, you might want an alternative way. So, I mean, the fact that there is a solution somewhere that doesn't stop us from looking for another. Okay? Second problem, determine the unknotting number of a knot. So if you have a knot, you can always, by a number of crossing changes, bring it to be the unknot. And the question is, what is the minimal number of knotting, of crossing changes you need in order to bring the knot to be the unknot? And then the last of those three problems is to decide whether a knot is a ribbon. So, what's a ribbon knot? So, well, quite clearly, every knot is the boundary of a disc immersed into R3. Immersed but not embedded. Knots that are the boundaries of embedded discs are called the trivial knot, right? Because if you're the boundary of an embedded disc, you can shrink the knot along the disc until it's a little loop, and then it's trivial, okay? But then there is something intermediate between arbitrary immersed disc and embedded disc, and it's called a ribbon disc. So a disc that is allowed to have only so-called ribbon singularities. And here's the picture. So the disc here is in green. The boundary of the disc is in, I guess, darker green. And it's the knot itself, and I'm of course showing only parts of it, so the disc looks like two ribbons, but presumably they will connect somehow to form a disc. And a ribbon singularity is a singularity that locally looks like this. And the formal definition is the singularities that are allowed are, well, we allow double point intersections, and then the set of double points will form a one manifold, and in fact the components of this manifold, of this one manifold, well, you know, let's look at them in the target space. So here is the one manifold, okay? But the pre-image of this one manifold in the parameter space has two components, right? One component kind of on this part of the disk, and the other component on this part of the disk. And to be a ribbon, the two components have to be of the following form. One component should be completely internal, and the other component should be going from boundary to boundary. Okay? This is a supposed to clasp singularity. Sorry, that's not cusp, it should be clasp. So this is a supposed to clasp singularities, which I'm not allowing in a ribbon knot. And a clasp singularity is, well, the inverse image in the two parts of the disk will look like, well, in one part it will be an interval going from the inside to the boundary, and on the other part it will be again an interval going from the inside to the boundary. Okay? So, examples. Here is a ribbon knot. Okay? You can, basically the ribbon is sort of the, well, it's by the way sometimes called the handshake knot, because it's like two hands clasping, shaking each other, holding each other. But it's also just the connect sum of the trefoil with its mirror image, but okay, but anyway, the ribbon is quite, the disc here is quite clear. So just take this ribbon from here to here, you know, connect a disc to it on one side, connect another disc to it on another side, and it's also visibly only ribbon singularities. The singularities are, well, there is one singularity here, and it's clearly a ribbon singularity, and another one here, basically where this handle rises up through, or sorry, where this band rises up through this handle, and the second singularity is when this band pushes down through this handle. Is it clear? It's less obvious, but provable, that the trefoil knot is not a a ribbon knot. Anyway, so my question is, given a knot, efficiently decide whether it's ribbon or not. Okay? Now again, there isn't a definitive way to do it. I don't think there is an algorithm, but there are criteria. Okay, there are statements like if the Alexander polynomial is blah blah blah, then it is not ribbon. Okay, so but again, it's always good to have more techniques, and I want to suggest a way of getting more techniques. And the point is that I don't want. I mean, this way of finding more such techniques, the sort of the underlying idea is that I don't want to care just about knots, but rather about some wider spaces, in this case knotted trivalent graphs, that also have some algebraic structure. So that there is some algebraic structure on that bigger space of knotted objects. Okay? So here's example number one. So claim the set of knots bounding a surface of genus 1 is equal to the collection of boundaries of gammas where gammas are knottings of a shape that looks like this, a graph, a trivalent graph that looks like this. But let me tell you about my conventions. When I talk about trivalent graphs, they're always framed. Okay? So, you know, I'm in the framed case of knot theory. So really, each of these edges is not a single sort of one-dimensional strands, but a thin ribbon. So the parameter space here looks like this, really. Okay? But then I'm allowing you to knot it arbitrarily in R3. Sorry. Okay? The boundary of such a thing is, well, just its boundary considered as a knot. Or if you want it to be the boundary considered as a framed knot, then take its boundary plus a little bit of a neighborhood into the inside. Okay? Quite clearly, the set of knots bounding a surface of genus 1 is equal to the del t of the set of knottings of this object, because this object is in itself a surface of genus 1. So if you... Okay, so I mean, there is just nothing to say. Okay? But the moral from it is that... No, you know what? No moral yet. Now let's get the moral. So, suppose I had an invariant, which isn't just an invariant of knots, but also extends to an invariant of knotted trivalent graphs, and for which... Okay, but sorry. And now, but I, so let's call this invariant Z. Now, I don't expect the target space of the invariant to be always the same, but I expect, you know, that the target space for knottings of this graph will be some space which I will call, which I can call A of that graph, and presumably it's some simply described space. I don't know, a space of polynomial, a space with some combinatorial definition. Some space relatively easy to describe, unlike the original space of knottings, okay? And likewise, I expect the invariant of an ordinary knot to lie in some algebraic space corresponding to an ordinary circle. And again, I expect it to be some relatively easy to manipulate space, okay? And the more interesting thing is that so there is a map from here to here, and I want So the invariant I want should have a map from the space of values here to the space of values here that makes the diagram commutative. Okay? If you find such a thing, so in other words, if you find an invariant of knotted Trevelyan graphs that has good behavior under operations of knotted Trevelyan graphs, so if you find such an invariant, then clearly V of genus 1 knots will be contained in the image of del A. Right? I mean, I think it's clear from the commutative diagram. So we have an algebraic criterion for deciding whether the knot is, sorry, whether the genus is not of genus 1. Sorry, is greater than 1. I think this should be greater than 1, not greater than or equal. In other words, if you're given a knot, you compute its z. If its z is not in the image of this algebraic delay, you know it's a knot of a high genus. Okay? By the way, this is sort of the same thing that happens in, the second class of algebraic topology. So in the first class, they teach you about homology. This is figuratively. In practice, classes are designed differently, okay? But figuratively speaking, in the first class, they tell you about homology, and you're very, very happy because you have a nice invariant of topological spaces, okay? And indeed, you can use it to separate surfaces, say. Okay, but then on the second day they tell you that that the invariant is functorial, meaning when you have maps between should I take pictures? Yes, I should. When you have maps between topological spaces, it induces maps between homologies, so you can start forming diagrams like Sn minus 1 goes to Dn goes to Sn minus 1 going this way. You can compute, you can apply the homology functor, you get Z 0, and basically, and you deduce the Brouwer's fixed point theorem from it. Okay? So in a similar way, I'm saying, knot invariants are good, but it's even better if you have good knot invariants with behavior. Okay? Okay. So next example. Similarly, I claim that knots of a knotting number 1, before that, for the previous example, I stopped at 1, but equally well I could have continued and talked about knots of genus greater than or equal to 7, right? So knots of genus at most 6 are knots that are the topological boundaries of embeddings of a parameter space which as a graph has genus 6. Well, I didn't count high enough, but you get the point. Okay? Okay, so now let's talk about knots of a knotting number less than or equal to 1. Again, it should be less than or equal to 1. So these are knots that have the following algebraic description. Okay? So they are knots of the form X, why T here, I don't remember, but anyway, X of gamma, where gamma is a knotting of a theta graph, and D of gamma is equal to the R naught, where the definition is, if you have a knotted theta graph, D of gamma, D of it is to just remove the middle bar, okay? And X of it is to pull one side of the knot along the bar, bring it to the other side with a crossing, and then let it go back. This is a well-defined topological operation. Okay? And I think it's obvious that this is a definition of not of a knotting number one, because basically saying that a knot belongs to this set means that going from here to here is doing a crossing change. So this means that you can find a way to do a crossing change so that you get the R-knot. Or rather, you can get our knot from the R-knot by doing a single crossing change. Okay? So again, if I had a well-behaved invariant of knotted trivalent graphs, Z, well-behaved meaning, well, the invariant of knots should be in some space A of knots. The invariant of theta graphs should be in some space A of theta graphs. The invariant of knots, once again, should be in the same space. And I have an invariant Z that makes this diagram commutative for some algebraic operations, XA and DA. Oh, now I remember what the T was. T was the topological X and the topological delete, the topological T. And A means the algebraic delete and the algebraic X, okay? Anyway, once you have such a commutative diagram, the set of knots or the set of invariants of knots with a knotting number less than or equal to 1 is contained in a set with an algebraic description. It's written here and it's sort of clear from the diagram. And we have a chance to say something about knotting numbers. Okay? Good. And then the last example, and the last example is the prettiest and the one I'm the most hopeful about, even though, in reality, all of this is still dreams. Because while I have invariants with good behavior under these operations, they tend to be not computable enough to actually get information. So some of it is still a dream. Anyway, claim, the set of ribbon knots is more or less equal to, I'll explain the more or less in a minute, okay? But the set of ribbon knots is more or less equal to the set of all unzips of knots gamma, which or knotted graphs gamma, which are knottings of a shape like this, so kind of dumbbell or eyeglasses or whatever. Okay? Whose delete is the two-component unlink. So I guess I should explain. Unzip means, I guess I should have written it somewhere. Unzipping an edge means doing the following. So if you have a local picture like this, unzipping it will mean replacing, well, basically think that there is a zipper inside and unzip it. So you replace it by this, okay? And this totally makes sense if my edges are actually little bands, and that's why I like framing so much, because framing turns edges into little bands, and then all these operations become well-defined. Okay? And delete is the operation of deleting this edge, which is always well-defined. If you delete it, you just get a thing like that. So, again, if you unzip the middle edge here, you will get a single component knot, right? And if you delete, you'll get a two-component knot. And my claim is that ribbon knots are unzips of gammas like that, whose delete is the two-component unlink. Why? So, you see, suppose the delete of gamma is the two-component unlink. then you can, to say that it's the two component unlink means that you can seal each of the components with a disk. You can put a disk inside each of these components. Now, this disk will be, well, these two disks will be disjoint and disjoint of the two components, except the boundaries, okay? But when I've put in these two disks, I mean, I completely ignore, I've done it after deleting the middle edge, so they might still intersect the middle edge, right? But now what I can do is I can take this middle edge and replace it by a band, and now I got a disk of the shape, well, the two disks taken together along with the band is still just one big disk, but the only intersections I may have are intersections of the band with the inside of these disks. But this is a ribbon singularity. So I've proven to you that any knot here is a ribbon knot. Okay? Example. Take, for example, this knotted dumbbell. Its delete is clearly the unknot. Its unzip is the ribbon knot we had before. And the construction of the ribbon is exactly the construction I've described. Okay? Why did I say more or less? Because, well, I've only proven one side of the inclusion. The other side of the inclusion is false. If you want the other side of the inclusion to be true, the only thing you have to do is to, instead of looking at dumbbells, you have to look at sort of multiple dumbbells, at things that look like this. You have to make it a multiple, and then unzip will be unzip everywhere, and delete will be delete all. Okay? And then it's a theorem, which I will leave for you as an exercise. Okay? It's not too hard. Okay? But anyway, the moment you had an algebraic knot theory, so the moment you had an invariant of dumbbells with values in an algebraic space for dumbbells, an invariant of two component links with blah blah, an invariant of one component links with values in a space for one component links, and everything making this commutative, well, you'll have a chance to say something about ribbon knots. Okay? In particular, there is a famous conjecture about, or open question about ribbon knots. So there is a similarly defined class of knot called slice knots. And so a slice knot is a knot that bounds a disk. Okay, so, sorry, what's a slice knot? So knots live in S3. Right? S3 is the boundary of B4, the ball of dimension 4, and a slice knot is a knot in S3 that bounds a non-single and a non-self-intersecting and embedded disk in B4. And there are some subtleties about it, whether you want it to be smooth or topological, but I think slice means smooth, but I might be confused. Okay? Anyway, it's not hard to show that every ribbon knot is slice. It's an open problem whether every slice knot is ribbon. So what is needed is a criteria to show that... So if you wanted to find a counterexample to this conjecture, you would need a way of showing that some given slice knot is not ribbon. So you need a criteria for detecting non-ribbon knots. And that's what this will give you. Okay? Because it tells you that the set of ribbon knot is contained in some set with an algebraic definition. So so in principle, if you compute Z of a ribbon knot and it doesn't fall within that set, sorry, if you compute Z of a knot and it doesn't fall within that set, you know it's not ribbon. Okay? As I said, so all of this is dreaming. I do have invariants that have all these lovely properties, they are not sufficiently computable. So in some sense, the big thing that I want to work on is computations, and I will talk to you about computations later on. Okay? One of the big things I want to do is not just to define invariants, but to be able to compute them. And again, I'll be talking about this later on. So anyway, the bottom line is many interesting properties of knots are definable, algebraically definable, using knotted trivalent graphs, which are, well, I think by now you understand what they are, and the basic operations on knotted trivalent graphs are, well, the edge delete, the edge unzip, and also the connect sum, which is a binary operation. So if you have two knotted trivalent graphs, you can take and the choice of an edge on one and the choice of the edge of another, then it makes sense to take their connect sum by adding another edge in between. And if you want a further little exercise, verify that everything that the three examples that I gave, the operations I used are compositions of these ones. So these are sufficient. Okay? What I really want is a TGE, a trivalent graph morphism into algebra. So for every graph, I want an algebraic space A of gamma. I want an invariant from the knottings of gamma to the corresponding algebraic space. I want operations D, U, and connect sum defined algebraically on the algebraic spaces, and so that all the relevant diagrams would be commutative. Okay? Oops. Okay, this is already too much. I guess at some point today, I hope I will say that not only I have such a thing, but it's precisely equivalent to the theory of associators, which is good and bad news at the same time. It means that I have it, but on the other hand, I don't really have it because I can't compute anything. So it doesn't look like it, but this is a rephrasing of the theory of associators. Yes?
Is the map Z somewhat invertible?
Is the map what? Z invertible? No.
So if it's not invertible, that means you lose information.
Of course. Invariants always lose.
So it's like you are...
No. Invariants always lose information. Or not always, okay? I mean, the identity... But typically, invariants lose information. Invariants give you a way to show that two knots are different from each other, but not a way to show that two knots are the same. Likewise here, I will always get criteria only in one direction. So, like here, I might get, a criteria to show that a knot is not ribbon. From this, I will never get a criteria to show that a knot is ribbon.
So you have a non-computable invariant.
What?
So you just mentioned this invariant is not practical to compute.
Again, it's theoretically computable. It's given by the Concievich. It's given by variants of the Concievich integral. Whether it's computable or not, you know, theoretical mathematicians think that the minute you write an integral, it's computable. But I'm sort of not a theoretical mathematician. I'm a computer technician. So for me, writing an integral is like an abstraction that's later to be replaced by something real. Okay? Sorry, I'm pushing in various ideological statements. And of course there is something much worse than finding than writing an integral, and it's to use the axiom of choice. Okay? So let me use the axiom of choice. Okay? So far we only have universal finite type invariant, Z of nodes into A, into the space A, but over the complex numbers, right? What if I wanted an invariant over the rational numbers? Okay, so if I were a theoretical mathematician, I could tell you that there is a Q linear map from C to Q. Use it to write using a Hamel basis or one of these unreasonable things that set theorists believe exists, and you will get a map into the rational space of chord diagrams. And since the condition defining a universal finite type invariant is in fact over the integers, it will be preserved. Okay? So here you go. I've just constructed a rational universal finite type invariant. It's an order of magnitude more useless than the Concievich integral, but well, okay. I just did it for fun. Okay? Please forgive me. Do I have time? How much time do I have? 5 minutes. Okay. So let me. Oh, so you know what? Yes?
No, just fighting about time.
Okay, so one more thing, if we're at it, about extending the Concievich integral. Here is a reasonable extension. This is actually completely computable. Okay? So remember that, well, the Concievich integral, the way I've defined it so far, was for unframed knots, which is exactly the opposite of what I generally want. Generally, framed knots are better. Okay? Now, there are two ways to fix it. Why was it about unframed knots? It was about unframed knots because I had issues near the ends of needles. Okay? I had various divergences. So one way to fix it is to study these divergences carefully, realize that they are somehow they're always of the same form, so you can renormalize them away, and then you get a working invariant. And again, that's not the way I'm suggesting right now. The other way is to do this exercise. So remember that A reduced, the target space of the reduced, of the unframed Concievich integral, is A modulo isolated chord. But by now I have a better language. I know that A is an algebra, and it's really A modded out by the ideal generated by the degree one single chord element of A. So this is an element of A, right? So let's construct a map from A reduced to A using the following formula. So really, I'll pretend that that this formula is defining a map from A to A. So from just arbitrary chord diagrams to chord diagrams. But the point is that it will be a map that maps the ideal generated by theta to zero, and therefore it descends to a map from A reduced to A. Anyway, what's the map? So when you evaluate it on an arbitrary diagram D, you do the following. You take the sum as K goes from zero to, well, the degree of the diagram, to infinity, but the sum is finite, F minus theta, this theta, to the power k divided by k factorial, times the kth derivative of the diagram D with respect to theta to the power k. What's the kth derivative of a diagram? By definition, the derivative with respect to theta of a diagram, what's the derivative of x to the n with respect to x? It's the sum of all ways of like, what's x to the n? It's x, 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 written n times. And then the derivative is the sum of all ways of crossing out one of the x's. X-ing one of the x's, right? And then you'll get, since there are n x's, you'll get n times x to the n minus 1. So in a similar way, I'll define the derivative with respect to theta to be the sum of all ways of dropping one of the chords. Check that it's a well-defined operation. And likewise, d to the k, well, doing it k times means dropping one chord and another, then another k times. Sorry?
You explain what is the meaning of taking the power by k of theta.
Nothing. That's how people write the derivatives in calculus.
Minus theta.
Here? Oh, powers in this algebra.
Which, how do you draw this?
Well, it's an algebra. Remember, A was an algebra last time we showed it. So, okay, fine.
Can I give an example just one?
Of course, of course. Okay, here is theta cubed. So, first of all, what's theta? Theta is theta. Powers were defined on the long line version. So, it's really a long line with a single thing. To multiply it by itself three times will give you, so theta cubed will be a long line with three, or basically three copies of the long line concatenated. So you'll get this. And if you want to write it as along in a circle, you just close, so this is theta cubed. Can you see it or? Okay. So this is f of d. By the way, if you look at this formula, it looks like a Taylor expansion of something. And in fact, it's the Taylor, well, you know what? I'll leave it to you to figure out which Taylor. It's essentially the if we pretend that a diagram D is a function, then this is the evaluation of the function at theta equal to zero. Okay? But anyway, now the claim is that, okay, sorry, first claim is that F indeed defines a map from A reduced to A, and then the second claim is that if K is a framed knot, then the following combination is a universal finite type invariant of frame knots. So you take the self-linking number of k, multiply it by theta, exponentiate in the same sense of formal power series, and multiply it by f of the old Koncievich integral. Okay? That's all I have to say. But the point is, everything here is completely computable and is soft, does not use any high mathematics. So in principle, so the problem is solved. Yes?
So how do you show that it's a universal finite type invariant?
Well, that's the exercise.
No, but I mean, so what's the, definition of...
The usual definition. So you have to show that that this new Z, you know what, maybe I should separate the two Z's. So this is Z old, okay, for the Koncievich integral, the ordinary Koncievich integral. So you have to show that Z of a knot with n double points, let me draw one, for example. Here is a knot with three double points. You have to show that Z of it is the chord. So in other words, if you take the alternate, if you expand this to a 2 to the 3 knots and compute Z of all of them and all of that, then Z of that is the chord diagram that underlies this picture. So I believe this chord diagram is this. So these two crossings make an X, and the point of adding this one was to create the isolated chord. So this is what you have to show. Okay? Good.
Could you repeat what was SL?
Sorry?
SL of K?
SL? Self-linking of K. So a frame note has a self-linking. It's the linking number of the knot with its framing.
Okay.
Or a frame knot is really a little knotted band, right? So it's the linking number of the two sides of the band.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. You know, I wish I had more time because there is a fun story behind this. I mean, there is this sort of Taylor's theorem, and there is a little bit of kind of... Well, you know, here is another little check. Check that d to d theta commutator with the operation of multiplication by theta is the identity. So this is the Heisenberg commutation relation, and it goes sort of, you know, you can prove this by brute force, but you can also prove it by saying, oh, it's analogous to things that happen in basic quantum mechanics. But I don't have the time, and it's sort of completely a side issue, so I want to drop it.
The rule for checking that something is a Vasiliev invariant for frame note is identical to ordinary notes?
Sorry, say it again?
When you want to check if something is a Vasiliev invariant, in fact, a invariant for frame notes, the rules are the same.
Yeah.
The framing will not change during the...
Yeah. So framings, you can carry framings from before and after in an obvious way.
The framing will not change during the process of...
Yeah.
Can I ask for a favor?
Yeah.
So that I understand it better. Can you please compute, can you give an example or compute the derivative of some diagram with respect to theta? Just the first derivative?
Sure. Okay, let's do d to d theta of this diagram. Okay, so d to d theta of this diagram, again, it's just like ordinary calculus. It's the sum of all ways of dropping one chord. If you drop this chord, you get this diagram. If you drop any one of these two chords, you get the same thing, so you get plus twice this thing. Okay? Other questions?
Is the motivation of F somewhat motivated by the symplectic volume form?
No.
So
at least I don't know how to relate it with the symplectic volume form.
So if you just ignore the input C and collect the theta with the differential, so that part I guess you could view as the symplectic form. The overall formula would be E to that.
I see no relationship with the symplectic volume form. I don't know. I mean, to me, I don't know what to say. Let me tell you how I see it. Since I started saying it, I will say it, okay? So, suppose you had a function, let's call it, D. Okay? Suppose you have, D is differentiation, it's diagram. Okay, so what should I, phi, okay? Suppose you wanted to evaluate phi at zero. Here's a strange way of evaluating phi at the variable theta is equal to zero. Well, you say, let's evaluate it at theta minus theta and call this theta theta and call this theta delta theta. Sorry, this minus theta, delta theta, and then use Taylor's theorem. So by Taylor's theorem, this is a sum of d to the k phi d theta to the k, that's the nth derivative, times minus theta, that's delta theta raised to the power k, and I suppose divided by k factorial. That's exactly the formula that's written over there. So really, that formula that's written over there is a way of writing evaluate at zero using the operations we have. Using operations, I can define diagrammatically. But, you know, I think this only served to add to the mystery. And well, so, you know, mysteries are good. I mean, you should your purpose should be to remove them.
Two thetas are not the same.
Which two thetas are not the same?
I don't know.
Okay. I don't know. Okay, let me quit now. Again, it's in a sense this is an aside. So, okay, so let me quit and we'll go back after the break.